This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. U.S. Marine Corporal Cesar Lorien, the principal suspect in the murder of 20-year-old pregnant Lance Corporal Maria Lauterbach, is believed to be on the run in Mexico, and the search for him is now well underway. The FBI, U.S. Marshals, and local police are coordinating their efforts in an international manhunt. But just how do they go about finding a fugitive? Phone taps, rewards, tip lines? What if you don't have a picture, just witnesses? And what do you do if a skilled hunter or a trained soldier vanishes into the woods? Today we'll talk with a former FBI agent, a forensic sketch artist, and a wilderness tracker. If you've ever been involved in a manhunt or picked a face off the most wanted list, or if you have questions about how all of this works, our phone number is 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. And you can also join the conversation on our blog. That's at npr.org/blogofthenation. Later in the program, George Packer, the author of The Assassin's Gate, on his new play about the Iraqis who worked for the U.S. in Baghdad, Betrayed. But first, tracking a fugitive, and we begin with Clint Van Zandt. He's a former U.S. Army intelligence agency and worked at the FBI for 25 years, including time as chief hostage negotiator and as supervisor in the Bureau's Behavioral Science Unit. He joins us by phone from Fredericksburg in Virginia. And Clint, nice to have you back on the program.
Neil, it's always good to be with you.
And of course, we're speaking hypothetically, but if you don't know where a suspect is, do you begin with who he is?
Well, of course, you know, the question you always have to answer is who. In this particular case, the FBI, the U.S. Marshals Service, they're not concerned necessarily with the crime that he's alleged to have committed, in essence, in this case, murder. What the federal authorities are looking for him for is a federal warrant that was issued for unlawful flight to avoid prosecution. That basically says the FBI has reason to believe this individual fled from one state to another or even out of the country to avoid local prosecution. It's the job of the feds, the FBI, the Marshal Service, to find him and then get him back into the country. Then it will be the job of the local authorities to handle the substantive crime, in this case, the murder investigation and prosecution.
And because in this case it's a Marine, there's a lot of information about him on file, including fingerprints, pictures, and that sort of thing.
Well, there's fingerprints, pictures. They'll have DNA sources available for him. They'll know his tattoos. They'll know his relatives. Whenever he came into the Marine Corps, now realize he's a naturalized U.S. citizen, so he was a Mexican national, came into the United States, was naturalized, came into the Marine Corps. So they will have a complete dossier on his background, who his relatives are, which will greatly aid in the hunt for him. We know, the FBI knows he's down in Mexico. They have eyewitness identification, people who saw him on a bus going from the United States into Mexico, in which he engaged in conversations, and even though he used one of his known aliases, indicated that he was a Marine. So there's not a question that he did, in fact, enter Mexico. A relative saw him at a liquor store, so we know he's been seen down there. The question now is, where do we get him, and how do we get our hands on him and get him back? Realize that, of course, the FBI cannot go charging across the border, guns drawn, and arrest someone in a foreign country. They have to rely on the aid and assistance of Mexican authorities to help conduct the investigation as well as to conduct the arrest, get him to the Mexican-U.S. border, shove him across the border, and then he's back in U.S. custody.
And that could involve some legal processes as well, of course, in terms of, you know, appeals against extradition, that sort of thing. But that all remains in the future. Obviously, the FBI would then want to provide Mexican authorities with as much information as they could.
Yeah, and they have. They've gone to some interesting and unique means, Neil, at this point to find him. Number one, in the United States, they activated a series of dozens of electronic bulletin boards on interstates where his picture and background information was shown in areas that they thought he might have fled to. Now, since they believe he's in Mexico, they have the traditional wanted by the FBI wanted flyer poster containing all of his information, his aliases, his physical description, as well as information about a $25,000 cash reward. That has all been converted into Spanish, and it's been circulated in areas that he's believed to be in Mexico. So what the FBI is relying on is hopefully the good faith of Mexican authorities to help find this guy, as well as a $25,000 cash reward. And then the other normal investigative techniques, as you suggested, they have phone taps and PIN registers on all of his relatives in the United States. They're monitoring any credit card, any cell phone activities, any electronic signal, any electronic transfer of money, anything that can be digitized. These can all be followed and tracked back to him.
We're talking with former FBI agent Clint Van Zandt about how to track a fugitive, how you conduct a manhunt. 800-989-8255 if you'd like to join us. Email is talk@npr.org. And let's get Michael on the line. Michael's with us from Miami in Florida.
Good afternoon. My comment is that given the fact that he's a Marine, wouldn't that present a greater challenge in tracking him down, because he's pretty slick at ducking authorities because he's had extensive training in the military?
How would that change things, Clint?
Well, he's a Marine. Realize that he's never been deployed in a combat situation. He's been basically a clerk. Now, everyone knows if you're in a Marine, your basic MOS, you're a gunfighter, you're an infantryman, and I understand that.
Every Marine is a rifleman.
Every Marine is a rifleman. But in this particular case, his rifle has probably been a desktop computer that he's done most of his rifle work on. So I wouldn't suggest this guy is necessarily an experienced person in escape and evasion. I think what he's relying on is the ability to somewhat start to disguise his appearance, grow his hair out, wear sunglasses, do other things, his obvious knowledge of the Spanish language, and to be able to prevail upon friends and relatives in Mexico to help hide him from the U.S. authorities. Now, I think that $25,000 cash reward may well go a very long way there, and he's not the type of guy that, from my knowledge of his background, he's necessarily going to be camping in the desert and cutting cactuses and have to get water out of them to drink.
Another aspect, though, this is a guy about whom there's, you don't want to prejudge, of course, but there's a lot of evidence. Yes. He may not think he's got an awful lot to lose once authorities close in on him.
Well, you know, that's always the challenge. As an FBI agent for 25 years, and when I was out attempting to arrest fugitives, you always had to know that eventually I would become the person standing between the fugitive and what he thought to be freedom. And depending on the value that he put on his freedom, that took away from the value of my life. So the investigators, the agents, the authorities always have to realize that. And as you suggest, this is a crime he's suspected of. There's a ton of evidence to suggest he's involved. But for the purposes of the investigation, there's still a lot to be learned. His wife, for example, who's a Marine, she has been cooperating with the authorities somewhat. There's questions concerning what her level of involvement may or may not have been in the crime that he's alleged to have committed. But at this point, she's cooperating. She's helping the authorities, so there's no need to rush out and arrest her, as some people have suggested on television. Were I involved in the investigation, I would want to keep her talking as long as I can. Once I got him back into the country, then we could figure out who did what to whom.
Okay, Michael, thanks very much for the call.
Okay. Thank you.
Bye-bye. Let's go now to Will. Will's with us from Carmel, California.
Yeah, I just wanted to comment that it's not always very easy to recognize a fugitive. I would see SLA, Patty Hearst kidnapper member Emily Harris, on my post office bulletin board in the Excelsior District of California, San Francisco, routinely. I walked my dogs about five mornings a week in McLaren Park, and Emily would run by going the other way along the track in her track suit, in her running suit, and I never put the two together. And she didn't look that much different. And I just want to say that, you know, depending on the public is great, but we aren't necessarily going to be very easily able to recognize a fugitive.
Okay. Thanks very much, Will.
You know, Neil, I was involved in the hunt for Patty Hearst. I was in an FBI office in New York, and of course, the SLA situation took place in California. I spent the better part of a year each week running down leads, alleged lookalikes of Patty Hearst in the New York, Pennsylvania area. None of those had turned out to be her. So, you know, I agree with your caller. go through a lot of pieces of coal sometimes before you find the diamond you're looking for.
Well, joining us now is Detective Mary Brazos. She's the Bernalillo County Sheriff's Department forensic artist in New Mexico and is considered an expert forensic artist by the FBI. She joins us from member station KANW in Albuquerque, and it's nice to have you today on Talk of the Nation.
Good morning, sir.
And one of the things I know you do is to help people recognize people on the run by developing a composite artist sketches of fugitives of whom there are not pictures.
Yes, I can do that. It all depends on what they have as far as witnesses or victims.
Mm-hmm.
And if they don't have any other leads, then they call me and I assist in making a composite.
And this is something that we're led by television shows to think that's in every police station across the country. I read in your case, it's actually fairly rare.
What's fairly rare?
Your skill.
Yeah, it's really, I do work for, of course, the Bernalillo County Sheriff's Department, and I have done work for APD, for the federal government here and other agencies around New Mexico.
And one of the things that you can do, I know, is there are, what, programs or procedures by which you can take an old photograph and age it?
Yes, sir.
How does that work?
I can do that. Well, I have a really cool system at work. I have a tablet that's actually a computer, and you actually draw on that tablet like you're drawing on a piece of paper. And if you have a photo of someone, you can scan it into my system, and I can age him or change his looks. Or her looks, you know, taking away hair, adding hair, mustache, you know, making them look older, or whatever I need to do
and
on
every,
that person.
And every once in a while, I'm told, when you finish your sketch, the people, the witnesses, they cry.
Sometimes they do. You know, it's if it's in relation to a homicide, it can get pretty traumatic for them.
Suddenly recognize their attacker, yeah.
Well, they see it, and it it brings up a lot of emotion. And when you're doing the work, it brings up a lot of emotion and trauma that they remember. And I've had people break down in my office, but it's really rewarding, though.
Mary Brazos, stay with us. Also, Clint Van Zandt, a former FBI agent. If you'd like to join our conversation on how to conduct a manhunt, give us a call. 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. Stay with us. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Catching a criminal takes good police work. Even then, some fugitives can stay hidden for years. In a few minutes, we'll be joined by a wilderness tracker. Right now, we're talking with Clint Van Zandt, a former FBI profiler, and with Mary Brazos, a forensic sketch artist in New Mexico. And we're taking your questions, too. If you've ever been involved in a manhunt, or if you've got questions about how all this works, 800-989-8255, email talk@npr.org, and you can read what other listeners have to say at our blog, npr.org/blogofthenation. Let's get David on the line. David with us from Scottsdale, Arizona.
Hi, Neil. A question and a comment. No offense to Mary, the sketch artist, but I just don't think sketches seem to work. I've been following a few cases here in Arizona, the Baseline Killer sketches and the composites that were made for him, and now that there was a recent one with the Chandler rapist and he got caught. And the sketches, to me, don't look anything like the supposed killer, I should say.
Well,
how heavily do the FBI and law enforcement rely on these sketches when they're looking for someone?
Well, let's ask Clint Van Zandt about that.
Well, you know, I was just thinking of an example of this, Neil. Most are aware of the case of missing and assumed, perhaps kidnapped, Madeleine McCann. She's the 4-year-old British girl who disappeared last May while on a holiday with her parents.
That was my second question, sorry.
Doctors, right. Both medical doctors. That case has basically grown cold with the Portuguese police first suspecting a pedophile, then a British expat, then the parents, and now having gone full circle back to some unidentified pedophile again. And just last week there was a full-face sketch like Mary would have done released concerning this individual, concerning at least someone who was seen hanging around this resort and spending an extraordinary amount of time looking at children and knocking on doors, perhaps looking for a victim. Well, this picture has been circulated all over that part of Europe right now with law enforcement, both private and otherwise, trying to find the picture who is the individual who's portrayed in this picture. Is there such a person or not? And if so, did he have anything to do with the little girl's disappearance? Well, at this point, Neil, that's all the authorities have. They've washed out every other lead they have. This is what they have to run with. And whether, you know, whether the police believe this may be a good or a bad sketch, even though three people have said that's the guy, that's what he looked like, it still is going to, you know, the test of investigative time, whether he's found, whether he matches the sketch, and, of course, whether he had anything to do with the little girl's disappearance. But that sketch has given the authorities something to work with that until last week they didn't have.
And Mary Brazos, you said initially they come to you when they're out of other leads, and I guess your sketch relies a great deal on the information, the quality of the information you get from witnesses.
Yes, sir. The detective or the lead case agent, they're the ones that decide who should meet with me because it's their case. And then we go from there doing the composite.
Mm-hmm. And I understand when you do the composite, you don't want to know any information about the case.
No, I can't know any information pertaining to the case because that contain the composite. So I'm going in, you know, just by what the victim or witness is telling me.
So the fear is if you knew it was an alleged child molester, for example, you might it might actually change the way you draw him.
Possibly. It's just I cannot know anything about the suspect until I meet with the victim or the witness.
And what is your, forgive me for using such a bad analogy, what's your batting average? How often do your sketches come out and you say, after the guy's caught, that looks pretty good?
I've been very fortunate. The gentleman in Arizona, I've heard that quite a few times about people that do not believe this works. But if you talk to the agencies that I have worked with here, they would say, yes, it does work, and it's a tool like the gentleman from the FBI was saying. It is basically a tool and a resource. When you have used up all your other resources, you use this as a resource or as a tool, and then, you know, you go from there with investigators.
Mary, by the way, David, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you, Neil.
And Mary Brazos, thanks you for your time today. We know you're busy.
Thank you, sir.
Detective Mary Brazos of the Bernalillo County Sheriff's Department. She's the forensic artist there in New Mexico and considered an expert forensic artist by the FBI. And let's see if we can get another caller on the line. And let's go to Jane. Jane with us from Florida.
Hello.
Hi, Jane. You're on the air.
Hey, hi. How are you?
Very well. Thank you.
I work with the United States Marshal Service, and I look for fugitives. That's my job. I've been doing it for about 14 years now. And I consider us the experts in the field. And my concern is when other law enforcement agencies reveal to the press and others means to which we use to try and catch fugitives. And it's a little disturbing to wonder why we would make so much of that or talk so openly about some of our methods.
Clint Van Zandt, what do you think?
Well, you know, the reality is that between television and movies, so much is out there. There are other, I assume Deputy Marshall is on the line, having spent a lot of my career looking at fugitives too. I'm sure she, like I, there's a lot of things you hold back. There's a lot of investigative techniques that's never revealed. And then there are others that unfortunately find their way out into the media, and whether that's someone in law enforcement giving it up or whether that's someone in the media having some knowledge of what's going on, that's what we live with. I mean, we started with looking at license plates and trying to figure out who that would belong to, and we've moved up technologically in a lot of other ways, but it's hard to believe there's a fugitive out there today that hasn't watched some cop show on television that showed how we would go about catching a fugitive that didn't say to himself or herself, okay, I'll never get caught that way. But there's a lot of tricks I'm sure the deputy has in her bag and that other agencies have, too, that never get portrayed in the media or on television.
I would agree with you on that, but yet so much of what people take from television, thinking it's reality, when so much of a lot of the things that are done are very grassroots and just kind of bare bones. And I guess I just you see on the news and you even see police officers, whether it be upper level or lower level, when they are successful in their hunts, they want to,
give up those techniques.
You know, tap their chest to say, this is how we did it. We did it because we did X, Y, and Z.
On the other hand,
I understand the emotion behind it, but so many times it does a real detriment to what we do have in our bag as resources, because there are so many things working against us when it comes to whether it be phones and legal orders, and there's so many judicial areas where we can't go into to track and find some of these people.
Well, Jane, I hope we haven't revealed anything detrimental to you, and we wish you the best of luck. Thank you very much for the call.
Thank you.
Okay, bye-bye. Here's an email question that we have from Slick. Can bounty hunters chase into other countries, Clint?
Well, they can. Of course, Dog, the bounty hunter, found out when he got down into Mexico to grab someone, he got himself in trouble and got thrown into jail also. So whether Dog the bounty hunter is trying to go from Hawaii to Mexico and look for this individual, I think there can be illegal bounty hunters who are down there. But most countries like Mexico and others frown on, especially some other international, coming into their country. And as your last caller suggested, inserting themselves into an investigation. So I think there's lessons to be learned for bounty hunters to leave it to the professionals, especially when you get into an international environment.
Joining us now is Tom Brown, Jr., a wilderness tracker, founder of the Tracker School. He's worked with law enforcement agencies throughout the U.S. and internationally on cases involving abducted children, lost hikers, and fugitives. And he joins us now by phone from his home in Long Beach Island in New Jersey. Nice to have you on the line.
Thank you.
Can you describe the process of tracking a fugitive? Is it trying to follow a trail through the woods?
Well, basically, my environment is a lot different than you'd find in typical law enforcement. As you said, when the fugitive or lost person hits the bush, he's going to leave footprints, and that is what I do. Is me and my teams, we follow footprints in the woods. And footprints to us, with a lot of what I call dirt time, become like a fingerprint. No two people walk the same way. So part of our job in the beginning is to isolate and identify key points on a footprint that would indicate this is our target, this is our objective, and thus enable us to eliminate everything else and stay on that track.
And you must hate the rain.
Pardon?
You must hate the rain.
Yes.
And so as you're going about this search, clearly you and others like you are experts, but every once in a while you get a fugitive who knows his way around the woods as well.
Well, you know, that's subject to interpretation. I my school also deals in primitive wilderness survival, and I hear all these people thumping their chests of how good a survivalist they are. And, for instance, a case in point is Eric Rudolph. Where did they find him? Feeding out of a garbage can. And there's very
few... after a number of years on the run.
Yeah, well, he wasn't on the run the entire time either. He was stealing from farmlands and stuff like that. I mean, a pure wilderness survivalist is very difficult to find. There's very few of them out there. Eventually, they're going to have to make contact with civilization one way or the other.
And in the Rudolph case, there was at least suspicion that he had help from some of the people in the area.
Definitely, there's evidence of that, that he definitely had help stealing from grain factories, stuff like that, garbage cans, whatever. That is not a survivalist. That's nothing more than a homeless person that lives in the bush, as far as I'm concerned.
So if somebody goes out into the woods and tries to get lost, you're suggesting it isn't all that hard to find them?
No, not at all. The only time it becomes difficult is when there's too many searchers just doing what's called a visual search. I mean, a lot of times you do not have any other choice, but they should always let a trained tracker in first, whether it's a FBI tracker, local law enforcement, search and rescue, something like that, before the tracks become thoroughly obliterated.
Who is the most difficult of the people you've searched for to find?
Basically, number one is somebody who knows their way around in the woods and has had some kind of military training, especially dealing with escape, evasion, counter-tracking, and things like that. that makes a tracker's job more difficult. So what has to happen is you have to jump track or cut track, take an educated guess at direction of travel, and then go a mile or two up on that direction of travel and try to cut back and pick up the tracks to get through the places where he's tried to erase or obliterate his tracks or confuse the tracker.
Tom Brown, thanks very much for your time.
You're very welcome.
Tom Brown, Jr., a wilderness tracker and founder of the Tracker School, and he's worked with law enforcement agencies on cases involving, well, abducted children and fugitives. Well, with us from Long Beach Island in New Jersey, we're talking about how to conduct a manhunt, and you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's get another caller on the line. This is John. John with us from Santa Cruz in California.
Hi, nice to talk to you. I want to say that I really enjoyed listening to your show.
Thank you.
So I just wanted to say that as far as the artist sketch, it was pretty effective in my case. I was arrested due to a fairly good likeness of an artist sketch. I mean, it was pretty ridiculous. And when I got taken into the investigators, when I finally got arrested and was taken into the investigator's room, he had a almost full... the full body size of my face posted right in front of his desk. And I could just imagine him working and looking up and, you know, thinking about my face. And I'm just, and what happened was a person from that I had gone to school with was at a pizza store that I had robbed. And he recognized me and was able to contact authorities. And
so in your case... In your case, it all worked, and how long did you end up doing in time?
I did 2 years in prison, and I was able to get a sentence modification and to a treatment center. And I firmly believe that had I gone through my parole and never done the treatment, you know, I think that, you know, I just wanted to shout out that people can change. You know, I had a bad history, and my arrest was part of, you know, being able to get back into society in the right way. So some people can make it, and
okay,
whatever. But I just wanted to say that the artist sketches work. My wife's friend came over, and she saw it in the paper. It was posted in the paper, and my wife's friend came over and said, "This is your husband," and she said, "No way."
And it was well.
And it was.
John, thanks very much for the call, and continued good luck to you.
Okay, thank you.
All right, bye-bye. Let's see, we get one last caller in. David. David with us from Sonoma in California.
Yes, hello.
Go ahead, you're on the air, please.
Yeah, thanks. What I'm wondering is, you know, this is a high-profile, sexy case, and what I'm wondering is how much money and manpower goes into a case like this, possibly at the expense of lots of other unsolved cases and murders, you know, dangerous people out there.
Sure. Clint Van Zandt, any insight into that?
Well, of course, we know the $25,000 reward has been put up, but in the case of Mexico, every year we have 1,000-plus fugitives that are in actuality located in Mexico. They're brought back to the U.S. border, turned over again. I mean, I appreciate what your caller is saying, that even though this is a potential murder case, there are a lot of high-profile, perhaps terrorism cases. You know, your stalker or your tracker, Neil, that made me think of it. The British have developed software along the lines of what your tracker said, how different people walk differently. They lean one side or the other. The British have developed a software package that they can take the image of a terrorist, figure out how he walks, his gait, which way, and then compare that with other people they see on the street. So they, instead of identifying by someone's face, now they're trying to identify by the way they walk. So there's a lot of technology out there other than $25,000 on the barrel head being employed.
And just getting back to David's point, though, if in a case certainly like the one you worked on in the SLA case and Patty Hearst, such a huge profile case, does the FBI then steal resources from other investigations to focus on something that's become such a big deal?
Well, the answer is I think you do. I mean, those resources are finite. You only have so many men and women to dedicate. Now, the FBI has probably got half of their resources dedicated to terrorism today, and fugitive investigation is not necessarily high on the list. But it's always interesting how this, you know, the media can drive a case, him being a Marine, she was pregnant, all of these emotions that are involved in the case These decisions are not made in a vacuum. They're made in, if you can attach certain resources to a fugitive, and if you really do a full court press, might you be able to get that person off the street faster than if you didn't? Someone is making the decision in the case of this Marine that those resources would help bring him to justice where otherwise he might remain a fugitive and as a fugitive perhaps commit other violent acts. So that's how the decisions are made.
David, thanks very much for the call.
I hear the music. Thank you.
Thank you. And Clint Van Zandt, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Neil.
Clint Van Zandt, he joined us by phone from Fredericksburg, Virginia, former FBI agent. Coming up next, George Packer's new play, Betrayed. Stay with us. This is NPR News.